Good morning. Let's go ahead and get started. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Board pursuant to Article 40 of Title I, Colorado Revised Statutes. The date is May 25th, 2006, and the time is 9:10 a.m. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Suite 270, Denver, Colorado. The title board today consists of the following. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State here on behalf of Secretary of State Gigi Dennis. To my left is Sharon Eubanks, Deputy Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, who is here as the designee of the Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, Charlie Pike. Ms. Eubanks will be sitting as the Director's designee for agenda item number 1 and agenda item number 6. To my right, and for the other, I'll go ahead and get this out on the record as well. For the other agenda items, the director's designee is Dan Carton, who is also deputy director for the Office of Legislative Legal Services. To my right is Dan Domenico, Solicitor General, who is here on behalf of Attorney General John Southers. Mr. Domenico is the Attorney General's representative for the first and sixth agenda items. And then for agenda items 2 through 5, the Attorney General's representative is Jason Dunn, a Deputy Attorney General. There are sign-up sheets on the table by the back door for anybody who wishes to testify. Everything on our agenda today are motions for rehearing. And so, with that, I will... One procedural thing is on agenda item number 2, and this is 2005-2006 number 110. The proponents this morning did submit a letter to the Secretary of State's office withdrawing that measure from consideration. So since the proponents have withdrawn number 110, we will not take up agenda item number 2. Before I go into the agenda, though, there is another motion that I'd like to deal with. There's a motion to schedule rehearing, and I believe the copies are on the table by the back door. A motion submitted by Scott Gessler, indicating who has clients involved with the first five agenda items, and Mr. Gessler has. Scheduling conflicts from 1 o'clock 2:30 today, and his motion in effect is that the title board not take up those measures between 1 o'clock and 2:30, I think. So, Mr. Gessler, if you'd identify yourself and then just maybe summarize your motion, if you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. My name is Scott Gessler. I represent proponents of the first five. I should say litigants, either proponents or challengers in the first, I guess, four matters now that one has been withdrawn. My conflict is that I do have a Colorado argument before the Colorado Court of Appeals today, starting at 1:30. My motion for rehearing is simply a motion to schedule, and I guess I perhaps should have entitled it a motion to non-schedule. But I'm simply asking for the title board's indulgence in not meeting, at least on those particular issues, between approximately 1 o'clock and 2:30 so that I can go over to the Court of Appeals and present that oral argument. And then return. It's a conflict that, unfortunately, I think is irreconcilable in this matter. The Court of Appeals has scheduled this several weeks ago, and it's in an expedited matter as well involving election law. And then also, there are no other attorneys at my firm who can handle these matters on such a short notice tomorrow. I'm sorry, today, this afternoon. So I simply would ask the title board's indulgence in that. I'm hopeful, based on the agenda, that we may not even go to the afternoon. But if we do, that's my request.
Thank you. It does seem reasonable to me, and I do hope we're done well before 1 o'clock. Is there anybody present that objects to the motion for the motion to schedule or not schedule, as the case may be? Again, I think the motion would be that if we are not done by 1 o'clock, that we not take up those first five agenda items between 1 o'clock and 2:30. Is there any objection from anybody present? Don't see any. It does seem reasonable to me. Is there any discussion by the board? Is there
I'm ready for a motion.
Okay. I'm fine with the motion. I think that we should grant it if we have not completed our work this morning, that we would not take up any of the specified measures between 1 o'clock and 2:30 today.
And I'll second that. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Thank you, Mr. Gessler.
Thank you very much.
And let's turn to the first agenda item, which is 2005-2006, number 125, damages for mineral extraction. We actually have four different motions for rehearing, one filed by one of the proponents and then three others. And I'd pretty much like to take them as a group, maybe starting with the one filed by a proponent, but go ahead and hear from each of the petitioners on these motions for rehearing. And then we may act separately on them or together, I don't know. But let's start with the one submitted by John Gorman, since I think he's one of the proponents. Mr. Gorman, are you present?
I am.
If you could come forward, identify yourself for the record and who you represent. And
My name is John Gorman. I'm a proponent of ballot issue number 125. Our organization is Colorado Land Owners for Fairness, and I'd like to ask the title board to include a complete iteration of the initiative in the title. The initiative is clear and it is broad, but vague it is not. The words used are commonly understood words whose meanings are univocal and unequivocal. So I'd just like to ask you to append including oil and gas at the end of the wording of the title. One of the objections is that simply stating the language of an initiative does not necessarily make it clear, and that is true unless the statement of the initiative from the beginning was clear and simple, and I submit that this one is.
Mr. Gorman, you know, when the measure came up last time, the board was at a disadvantage because there were no representatives from the proponents, and one of the obligations of the board is to make sure that they do understand the measure, and typically that's how we start with a new proposal, is I give the board an opportunity to ask questions, and there were a great many questions about the measure, and I think to some degree that those questions are now reflected in motions for rehearing. But again, we didn't have the opportunity of seeking any clarification from the proponents last time. It may be that either now or after we hear from the petitioners on the other motions for rehearing, that there will be some questions.
Either I or Mr. Kaufman would be happy to answer any of your questions now or after some of the other petitioners have been heard.
Well, one question that I have is it, I mean, this is a constitutional proposal. There were a lot of questions having to do with the meaning of various terms. Is it your intention that the details such as definitions would be fleshed out in implementing legislation?
We hope not. What we hope to do with this is to set a principle and change the atmosphere in the negotiations between surface owners and mineral extractors. And we think that this is a strong enough proposal that indeed, if passed, it will change that atmosphere. If it does not, then there will be litigation and perhaps legislation that presents a more detailed relationship between a varying interest. But it was not our intention to stimulate legislation, although we saw that as a definite possibility. We also see litigation as a possibility. But we hope that people of the state of Colorado will avoid both.
The legislature would not be prohibited from proposing and enacting legislation, I take it. I mean, that's not your hope.
Absolutely not. Neither is it now. And in fact, it has made several attempts.
Are there any questions from the board members about the proposal itself or about the Mr. Gorman's motion for rehearing?
What specifically, what do you think adding the, I take it your motion is to just add the words including oil and gas to the
Correct.
To the title. What do you think that adds to the title that mineral doesn't, just leaving it at mineral doesn't include?
Well, mineral as a term understood in the industry includes, of course, oil and gas. But the common understanding of minerals among the people of the state of Colorado do not or does not include oil and gas. So this is just to emphatically state that what we're talking about. Because, and I invite you to down on the street here, ask 10 people, and then you will agree with me, because I've already done it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We may have questions later, but let's turn to the next motion for rehearing. I guess the next one I'll take up is Sean Gallagher for L. Roger Hudson and Ken Wanstolen. Mr. Gallagher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. I don't intend to replow ground that was plowed a week ago by Mr. Wanstolen. He made, I think, a very detailed and very eloquent explanation a week ago about a number of the concerns that we have. And I would just not restate those for the record, but since the record already contains them, I would ask that you review your notes from last week as well. As the Supreme Court has told us, titles must properly advise the voters of the operation of the measure. In short, this board has an obligation to call out a wolf in sheep's clothing when it sees one. The Supreme Court has told us that the title, the ballot title and the submission clause, is inadequate, where an important definition of an important term is not included in the title or the submission clause. The first question which this board needs to address is whether this initiative creates a new legal standard which is new and likely to be controversial. The answer to that is clearly yes. The rights of severed mineral owners to surface access have been a cornerstone of property law for 400 years, and Colorado has long recognized that right of access. In a long line of cases, Colorado courts have recognized the right of a surface owner to be compensated for unreasonable or excessive use of the surface. The conduct of oil and gas operations in Colorado also is regulated by the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission under the Oil and Gas Conservation Act. And pursuant to its implementing legislation, the commission has, through its spacing decisions, actually limited the number of wells that can be drilled on any given section of land, and has promulgated detailed and far-reaching rules designed to protect surface owners as well as to protect the public's health and safety. This initiative would fundamentally alter the basic and long-settled principles regarding ownership of property in Colorado. The next question, then, which the board must address is whether this new legal standard is likely to be controversial so as to require it, so as to require reference to that fact in the documents prepared by this board. Courts have told us that things like the square footage in a casino are not controversial for purposes of ballot initiatives, but abortion restrictions obviously are probably the quintessential definition of something that's controversial. Here, the issue between surface right owners and mineral extractors has been the subject of a long dialogue, most recently in the legislature, surrounding House Bill 1185. It's been the subject of much newspaper coverage. It was the subject of hearings and much debate within the General Assembly. So we think it's clear that this board should conclude that this would be a controversial subject as well. Therefore, the board has an obligation to prepare a summary which illuminates this measure, not necessarily restates it. Now, we're aware and mindful of the decisions of the Supreme Court that prohibit this board from interpreting particular measures that are in front of it, and we're also mindful of the decisions of the Supreme Court that caution that this board is not to be concerned with legal issues. We're not asking this board to interpret the measure, nor are we asking the board to render legal opinions. What we're asking the board to do is convey the primary purpose of this measure, which is namely to create new standards in Colorado for mineral extraction. Mr. Wonstolen also discussed in his testimony a week ago the fact that the title contains impermissible catchphrases, namely the use of the term fair value. Again, I don't intend to replow that ground, but it is one of the bases that we have moved for reconsideration. So for those reasons, we ask the board to reconsider its conclusions of last week and act in such a way that the new title and submission clause would fairly inform the public that this is a controversial issue and that enactment of this initiative would fundamentally alter Colorado law on mineral extraction, that it would alter the obligations and authority of the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and that it would require substantial legislation to interpret and implement the initiative. If there are no questions,
one question that I have, help me understand just a little bit better with how the board, in your opinion, should modify the titles to reflect this principle that you think the measure creates a new legal standard and so forth. Can you just help me a little more practically?
I think it should be modified to include a statement that this initiative would change established law on mineral extraction, would alter the responsibilities and authority of the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and would require a substantial legislation to interpret and implement the initiative.
Thank you. And then one other quick question. Would it be sufficient with respect to the catchphrase argument, would it be sufficient just to remove the word fair from the title set by the board? Or is something more required, or do you have another suggestion?
Well, I think clearly the phrase fair value is a catchphrase. I think the problem is when you remove the word fair, then you run into a vagueness issue. I understand vagueness is not necessarily an issue that this board needs to consider in the context of the enforceability, the constitutional enforceability of the initiative, but it renders, I think, the entire meaning of the initiative that much more amorphous and unclear to the members of the public.
Okay. Ms. Eubanks?
Thank you.
I think Ms. Eubanks may have questions.
I have a couple questions. In terms of the catchphrase argument, other than asserting that it is a catchphrase, could you elaborate any further in terms of why you think that's a catchphrase in terms of the analysis that the court has used as to what constitutes a catchphrase?
I'd be happy to do that. The court has in the past 5 or 6 years really sort of bounced around on the issue of catchphrases. In some opinions they found words to be catchphrases, in others they haven't. The court has told us that its task is to recognize terms that provoke political emotion and impede voter understanding as opposed to those which are merely descriptive of the proposal. So if we look at that standard, that the phrase fair value is in no way descriptive of the proposal, and in fact it is so ambiguous that it actually creates more issues than it solves. In fact, the proponents have told us a few minutes ago that they believe that litigation and legislation is a possibility. And I would suggest it's more than a possibility, it's a likelihood. It's a likelihood because Those phrases are not descriptive of the proposal. In fact, they create uncertainty. The other issue the court has tasked this board with evaluating is whether these statements provoke political emotion or impede voter understanding. Now, I don't know that the phrase fair value necessarily is the kind of phrase akin to a fighting word that incites, you know, people on the street to lose their tempers. But certainly in the context of the debate that went on within the legislature over House Bill 1185, the concept of fair value is an issue that many of Colorado's industries differ on in the interpretation of. So certainly within the group of citizens that would be affected by the enactment of this legislation, those terms might very well provoke political emotion. But moreover, and I think more importantly, they would also impede voter understanding. I think a voter looking at this would look at that phrase and say, well, I mean, it seems fair to me. It's kind of like saying, you know, are you against apple pie and, you know, motherhood? It's, you know, if there are very few people who are going to come out and say, I'm against fairness. So it is the kind of phrase that I think has an effect on the voter and impedes the voter's actual understanding of what the measure is intended to accomplish.
In terms of the argument relating to the title should somehow explain that the measure is creating this new legal standard, wouldn't you say that usually when there's an amendment to the Constitution or amendment to the Colorado Revised Statutes that that represents some change in existing law?
Well, I mean, by definition, anytime you amend the Colorado statutes, you've changed existing law. But that's not the standard that the Supreme Court applies. The standard isn't whether there's some change. The standard is whether there is an establishment of a new right or whether there is some material change in the law. So, yeah, I would ask this board not to focus on the fact that, you know, by definition, enactment of a new provision of the Colorado Revised Statutes changes the law. I think that really the question is, does this go beyond just a mere minor change, and does it constitute the creation of new either constitutional or statutory rights? And clearly it does.
Would you think that the court's decision on a waters rights initiative, which was back in 1994, where that proposal asserted to create a new and controversial legal standard, that the court did not find that title needed to say that was a new legal standard, it didn't need to be defined, it didn't need to be explained, just setting forth the new standard of whatever was being created in that initiative in terms of that being analogous to this situation where you don't really, other than having the standard as set forth in the title, that there's no obligation to go any further than that?
I think there is an analogous situation from 1994 from the Supreme Court, but it's not the Water Initiative, it's the Obscenity Initiative. It's found at 877 P. 2nd, 848. In that case, the court held that even though the language of the title set by the board was nearly identical to that of the proposed initiative, the title still did not fairly reflect the contents of the measure. The court held that the titles failed to sufficiently inform voters the measure was intended to prevent the state from adopting a definition of obscenity that was broader than that of the First Amendment. So I think that is at least the 1994 Colorado Supreme Court case that is more on point with this situation.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Gallagher? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to hear from Ed Ramey on behalf of Stuart Sanderson and James T. Cooper.
Good morning, Mr. Hobbs. Ed Ramey representing Stuart Sanderson. And we need to go through the disclaimers again.
I think they're on the record.
They're on the record.
Very good. Thank you.
That tends to consume time. I think to some degree our arguments are very similar, or our submissions are very similar to the ones that Mr. Gallagher just presented. With one exception, we have three items, and let me, I guess, take them out of order. Number two, I think the proponents, if I heard them correctly, addressed this morning. We believe that the specific inclusion of oil and gas, which for whatever reason is specifically included and referenced in the text, should be referenced in the title. I think I heard that echoed by the proponents. That is sort of what it is. With regard to number three, the cash frame, we agree, and as I read the objections coming next, Mr. Gessler's, and that is an issue there as well. I would agree with Mr. Gallagher's statements with regard to the cash phrase, and I think he put it very well when he said that the term fair value is, as far as I know, and as I think most of the voters would view it as, not a term of art that has sort of an encapsulated meaning, but it's a phrase that incorporates a sense of fairness, and everybody wants to be fair, and that carries sort of that loaded concept. The closest analogy that I can think of from my own memory, and I'm remembering all the cases I've either won or lost, usually lost at Mr. Kneiser's hands over the years at the court, but was the 2002, one of the 2002 English immersion initiatives where there was a phrase, rapidly and effectively as possible, which is about as close of an analogy as I could think. And the Supreme Court stated that was indeed a cash phrase, I think, in their first opinion on those issues that year, because everybody would like children to learn English as rapidly and effectively as possible, of course. And fair value is something like that. If there is damage, people would like to see whoever suffers that damage to be compensated in a fair fashion. Your question, whether you can just extract the word fair or you have to take the whole phrase fair value out, poses exactly the problem, I think, that Mr. Gallagher stated. You leave value in, what the heck does that mean? So there's a bit of a quandary there, and frankly, Mr. Hobbs, I don't have the answer to that, which I guess leads to my third point, and that is just the general confusion that and lack of clarity in the text of the measure itself, which presents, I think, the title board with some difficulty. I couldn't even begin to present the concerns, and I wouldn't even try, again, as well as Mr. Gallagher suggested, as Mr. Wonstolen did at the meeting at some length a week ago, and I think those are precisely the concerns. My question to the board goes a little further than Mr. Gallagher's, and I don't know if the board can set a title short of simply doing what the proponents advocated this morning, and that's just quote the measure, and then the text of the measure, and then the question is, minus the catchphrase, does that adequately inform the voters of what they're voting for? One other case, Mr. Gallagher cited the obscenity case, another case that the Supreme Court dealt with an issue in response to a question Ms. Eubanks asked a few moments ago about changes in the law, that of course a constitutional amendment is changing the law, but in 1990 or 1992 or thereabouts, the parental notification for abortion provision that was on the ballot at the time incorporated within it a change in the definition of when life begins. And the Supreme Court's guidance at that time, if I recall the opinion correctly, was not that you couldn't do it, but that if you're going to change a concept as important and as controversial as that sort of concept, when life is deemed to begin under Colorado law, that has to be clearly disclosed in the title. So I think that's another example of a case where the court has given guidance like that. On my first point, which echoes Mr. Wonstolen's argument last week, I'm a little more frustrated, I think, even than Mr. Gallagher is. I don't know how you do set a title. And I defer to the expertise of the board, but I would suggest that one consideration is that this measure doesn't lend itself to a title because you can't set a title. And in fact, you've been told this morning that whatever it means will have to get sorted out someday downstream, primarily through litigation, if not legislation. I'm just not sure this is not one of those cases where the board can't perform its statutory duty.
Questions, Mr. Domenico?
If I take it correctly, the argument that we can't set a title is that the measure itself turns essentially on a catchphrase, so that we can't set a title without using a catchphrase, and in addition, the catchphrase and the things surrounding it are so undefined and that we can't accurately set a title without getting into defining terms inappropriately, which we're not permitted to do, or analyzing it, which we're not permitted to do. Is that the argument?
I think so, and I was beginning to just object to the first part of your statement, Mr. Domenico, and that I don't think that just turns on the catchphrase. I think that's part of the problem. But I'd refer back to Mr. Wanstolen's presentation of last week. I think it's much broader than that. And the board's charge, as I understand it, with deference to Mr. Kneiser, who may give advice on this in a moment, but I think the board's charge is to set a fair and clear title. And if the board cannot set a fair and clear title, and there was a case out there, and I apologize that I cannot remember the case that I'm quoting, and everybody on the board probably knows exactly what case I'm quoting, but there was a case one time where the board said, the Supreme Court made the comment that they understood the quandary of the board confronted with the initiative it was confronted with, and the board apparently, in the court's view, did not understand the title and frankly couldn't have understood the title given the way it was drafted and therefore couldn't be the statutory charge. So the question is, what do you do in that situation? Is that a title anyway?
Right. Well, I agree that it's a bit of a quandary. My question, though, is the problem that there are all these terms that are going to be fought out later and aren't defined in the measure, does that fact in itself sort of make it impossible in your understanding?
No, not that fact in itself. The fact that terms would have to be fleshed out later, but it has to be clear enough, I would suggest, that the voters will have some idea what they're voting for. I mean, not necessarily in excruciating detail and not that there won't be litigation in implementing legislation, perhaps. But the voters have to have some idea what the meaning of a yes or no vote is. And I think one of the things that we've heard, primarily not from me but from others, is that it's very difficult even for the board to determine what a yes or no vote on this means.
I appreciate the logic of that, and the problem I have with it is I wonder what would we then do if we were brought a measure that said something along the lines of the state shall make no law abridging the right of free speech. That seems to be a catchphrase, at least as much as fair value is. It's undefined. It's been fought out in litigation for hundreds of years and will continue to be. And so my question is, maybe it seems to me that perhaps what the title does is inform people that they're voting on something that includes vague terms, and that's our role, not to try to explain to them what those vague terms may mean, because you're right, we don't know. And so I wonder, the logic of your argument is appealing, but it suggests to me we'd have trouble with something like the First Amendment.
I think, Mr. Domenico, you've very eloquently identified a distinction that I'm not very eloquently making. I mean, I think there's a difference between breadth and scope, and the proponents even referred to that this morning. First Amendment certainly is broad in scope. The old Parental Rights Initiative, which was something to the effect that the government shall not interfere with the parents' rights to control the upbringing, education, and the discipline of their children, clearly broad in scope and intended to be. That's a little different from some of the questions that I heard coming from the board last week and that Mr. Wanstolen was suggesting, that aren't really questions of scope. It's really a question of lack of clarity of intent. And what I heard this morning from the proponents is the intent, at least in part, is to change the tenor of the discussions, if you will, in the future, perhaps without necessarily providing that clarity. So that may be something of that may be somewhat intentional. But I think there's a difference between intended broad scope and using terms that scoop in a lot as the First Amendment, the Parental Rights Initiative did do, but as compared with the text of a measure where you as a board look at it and you say, I don't know if I'm voting yes on this, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm voting for, which is exacerbated, of course, by a crucial catchphrase that I think would have to come out and makes it worse. So I'm merely taking, I guess, Mr. Gallagher's statement. Mr. Gallagher would like you to fix it and sort of challenge the board to, mm-hmm. to fix it and make it more clear. And if the board feels they can do it, more power to you. If the board feels you can't do it, and I defer to the three of you on that, if you feel you can't do it, I think the court has given you an out, saying if you can't do it, you can't. If you can't write a clear title where the import of a yes or no vote can be understood by the voters, then you'd violate your statutory charge to set a title, notwithstanding that. I'm taking your question and spinning around, tossing it back to you, and I don't know the answer. If you feel you can set a clear and understandable title, by all means, I think that's your statutory charge no matter what I say, but if you can't, I think the court has suggested don't.
Thank you.
Thanks. Any other questions? Thank you. Next, I'd like to hear from Scott Gessler on behalf of Howard Stanley Dempsey, I believe it is. So, Mr. Gessler.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. I would also like to enter an appearance on behalf of Mr. Chris Elliott as well. So I'll be representing both Mr. Stanley and Chris Elliott in my comments. Christopher Elliott. Obviously, I'm... based on my motion for rehearing, echo many of the comments made by Mr. Gallagher and Mr. Ramey. I'll try and just point out my differences, proving the point you get three lawyers on the same issue, you'll get three different arguments. I'd like to talk first about the issue of fair value. That suffers, I would argue, from two infirmities. Okay? One is that it's vague and the board can't set a title for that. And I'll talk about that in a moment. But the one I'd like to focus on is its use as a catchphrase. I certainly agree with everything Mr. Gallagher and Mr. Ramey have said. I would add one other point. Another standard for catchphrase is, does it form the basis for a political campaign? That's in the Supreme Court case law. And if you look, in fact, at the protest, at the proponents' motion for rehearing, they fashion themselves as the Colorado landowners for fairness. So in other words, they are taking that use of the word fair, taking the theme fair, and they're turning it into the basis of their political campaign seeking mere fairness. That's the essence of a catchphrase, and that's why we don't want to have catchphrases in the title, because they form the basis of political campaigns in a very emotion-laden way. It brings an emotional content, emotional component into this, and as Mr. Ramey said, who can be against fairness? Everyone wants fairness because it's just right. So we have to remove the term fair. That brings us to the second point, and that has to do with the ambiguities and the inability to understand this this title itself. I respectfully submit that the title board committed two analytical errors when it reviewed this issue before. The first error that I believe is that, I hate telling the tribunal that it goofed, but I guess I'm here to do that. The first point is that the ambiguity and vagueness of a statute or of a proposed initiative, that analysis is separate from a single subject analysis. Okay? They're related, but they're two different steps. And I'd argue what this board needs to do first, the very first thing a board needs to do, is understand what the initiative does. And that's the very first thing it has to do in order to set a title that accurately reflects what it does. It has to understand what it does. So yes, there is a necessity for this board to interpret the law, to interpret the proposed law and interpret what it means. And the board obviously relies on the normal canons of statutory interpretation. First canon is to look at the plain language. Second is to obtain some sense of intent, provided that's consistent with the plain language. And that's, of course, why the board always asks proponents what their intent is, and that's why it's a relevant inquiry. What this board has to, as the very first step, understand just what the heck this thing means. The second step is to set a is to determine whether or not it meets the single subject requirement based on its initial determination. And, of course, the third is to set a title. Now, here we seem to skip directly to the single subject. I mean, people couldn't quite understand what it meant. And I think part of the evidence of that is, comments by the board, well, whatever we do, we're just going to have to include the actual language as part of the title, because that's the only way we're going to capture this thing. And I would argue that the reason you came up with that conclusion was a valid one. You can't put it in other words, because we don't know how to put it in other words that would capture other words that capture what this means. So the board sort of said, well, we have a sense that it means single subject. I mean, that's probably correct. I mean, it has to do with obligations of mineral extractors. I mean, that in its of itself is an adequate single subject. But you still have to get over the vagueness hurdle. And I'd like to talk just a few more details about why this is so vague and why it's impossible to truly understand what it means. First of all, let's look at the term value. Mineral extractor has to pay value. Like a mineral extractor, we can probably figure out, but she'll pay the fair value of damages. Well, I mean, there's sort of two conflicting and diametrically opposed ways of interpreting this. One is, when a mineral extractor purchases mineral rights on the fair market value, that fair market value that has already incorporated, from an economic standpoint, the damage, both the costs and the benefits associated with that mineral right. For example, the fair market value will assume that minerals cost so much, that it costs so much to remove them, and one of the cost components of removing them is paying for damages that are caused to the surface owner under Colorado law. But in other words, whenever a mineral extractor simply buys mineral rights, that automatically incorporates that fair market value in an economic sense, automatically incorporates the value of damages. So this doesn't change law at all under that interpretation. Under a different interpretation, and this is the diametrically opposed interpretation, that value, okay, this the value paid by the surface owner and the value paid by the mineral extractor, don't incorporate in any manner whatsoever the damages that can be caused to a surface owner. Okay? So what that means is a diametrically opposite interpretation. That every burden, every economic burden a surface owner obtains has to be paid. So I think just the use of the term value, okay, and in fact combined with sort of this unusual verbiage brought about in the development, pursuit, or extraction, creates two absolutely opposing interpretations, both supported by the plain language of the statute, or the proposed initiative itself. Two other problems. The term development and the term pursuit. These are non-idiomatic usages of these words. How do you develop a mineral? Okay. Normally we don't speak of developing a mineral. We speak of extracting a mineral. We speak of selling a mineral. You may develop, for example, a coal mine, a physical structure that is built. That's normally what development means. But to use the term as developing a mineral is non-idiomatic usage, and it's very unusual. What does it mean? We don't use that in our normal language. Under the second word, pursuit, what does that mean? Do you pursue a mineral? Minerals don't run away, obviously. Well, perhaps they seep away. But usually what pursuit usually means pursuing an opportunity, okay, pursuing a business deal, pursuing something that's mobile. But how do you pursue a mineral? We don't speak in those terms. We don't speak in terms of pursuing a mineral. Another ambiguity is the term brought about. Does that imply some form of causality or not? It's a term that people rarely use in this context. And finally, I've talked about the term surface owner. Okay? Well, if you look at this initiative, it does not limit itself to surface owners. Okay? For example, let's say a stockholder owns stock in a mineral extractor. Coal company, a mining company, an oil and gas company, okay? And what that, let's say, mining company does is it pursues a mineral opportunity. Let's sort of take this broad approach and digs a mine or digs a well. It comes up dry. And that stockholder loses money because the company made a bad bad mistake, pursuing a mineral. They're damaged. This initiative covers them. It is breathtakingly broad. It is basically a full, strict liability statute for all mineral extractors and what could conceivably be considered every activity that they undertake. Because if you take sort of the strange usage of development or pursuit, anything a mineral extractor does is part of developing a mineral or pursuing a mineral or extracting a mineral. Okay? And I could provide other arguments as to how this sort of works downstream in the production stream. I mean, if you're a seller of a mineral, simply a broker, are you pursuing that mineral? Well, you probably are. You're pursuing it from the person who extracted it, okay, and you're selling it. So I think that the way the verbs, in this instance, they're nominalizations, the nouns, development, pursuit, are not idiomatic usage. It's not clear at all what they mean, as well as the term value brought about. Nor is this limited, although we talk about it, nowhere in the language does it limit it to surface owners. It essentially creates a new cause of action, a strict liability cause of action, not based on reasonableness, simply for any damages caused by a mineral extractor. I've given you one interpretation, which I think is a very, well, I came up with it, so I think it's a very compelling interpretation. I'm sure you could hear plenty of other compelling interpretations that mean radically different things. And this language gives the title board no ability whatsoever to choose between these radically different interpretations. I'd argue that's the essence of vagueness and ambiguity, because how does the board interpret what this means in order to set a title? It can't. So we would argue, and I guess along those lines, we follow Mr. Ramey's argument, that this entire thing has to fail. I'd point out one other point, and this is going back to the, I mentioned two analytical errors. This is the second analytical error. The vagueness and ambiguity standard does not rely on the complexity of language. There's not a limitation that only complex language invokes the vagueness and ambiguity standard, but rather any language can invoke that standard. If it's vague and ambiguous, and the title board cannot understand what it means, it cannot set a title, regardless of whether one characterizes the language as simple or complex. And of course, the terms simple and complex themselves, I would argue, even if this court uses, or if this board uses the complex standard, this is very complex language. It's short. Complexity is not necessarily a function of the number of words. So for those reasons, as an initial matter, we think that it's impossible to interpret this in a straightforward, consistent manner. Therefore, there should not be a title set. It doesn't require complex language, and it's the very first step this board has to do. And I think what happened last week is that the board, and I understand exactly where you're coming from, said sort of, oh, this is too much of a problem to figure out what the heck it means. Let's just put the language right in the title, and that'll solve our problems. Mr. Gallagher pointed out that doesn't solve the problems. There is a case directly on point that says merely including the language of the title does not necessarily resolve the ambiguity problems. The board still has to do its duty and explain what it means. It is not sufficient simply to include the exact language of the measure. So those are my points, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Gessler?
I'd like to ask the same question I asked Mr. Ramey about. Could we not set a title for the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution? I don't see how those terms are any different than the terms you complain about here.
Well, I would argue that, no, you couldn't set a title for the First Amendment, okay? Just as you cannot set a title for Tabor.
Could we set a title to part of the first clause of the First Amendment? If we separated out each part, the free speech, the freedom of religion, could one of those be done?
If you can give me some exact language, I'd be happy to.
Well, how about
that.
This? Could we set a title to a measure that said, the people of Colorado should treat each other fairly?
Well, I would argue absolutely no. But that's a different basis. It sort of has the pieces possible. My interpretation is it requires some legislative mandate, and that's not a legislative mandate. But perhaps to try and get to the essence of your question, the title board is not the Constitutional Convention, okay? And obviously terms like freedom of speech, okay, have acquired, I would argue, over the 200-plus years of our country's history, have acquired an aura of perfectibility or an aura of the absolute fundamental standards of what we believe in. So whenever anyone says freedom of speech, that is almost it has become an expressive, emotionally laden term that everyone agreed to is a good thing. So to take that example, I do not think that the board would be able to include a phrase, freedom of speech, or shall guarantee freedom of speech. Again, I'd have to look at the exact context. But there's a high risk that is a catchphrase. And I can certainly see a group out there called Citizens for Free Speech, which takes the content of the initiative, takes the content of the title, turns it into a political campaign.
I might just go ahead and say that for the benefit of Mr. Gessler, if you want to comment, or anybody else, is Mr. Domenico's comments reflect exactly where I am at this mm-hmm. point on the motions for rehearing. I think this measure is a little unusual in that it is so short, but it does simply state a legal principle. And, I was looking through the Constitution, looking through Article 2 of the State Constitution, the Bill of Rights section, and section after section is three or four lines long, stating simple statements of general legal principles, a lot like this, I think. I mean, I was looking, trying to find the best analogy, and I think actually Mr. Domenico got a better one because of the catchphrase aspect as well, but I was looking at, there is Section 10, Freedom of Speech and Press. Section 13, right to bear arms. Section 14, taking private property for private use. Section 5, freedom of elections, which, speaking personally from my present job, I read it's barely over two lines. I've got a lot of questions about what that means. And each of these sections has pages and pages of annotations where those questions have been raised. And and going back to the right to bear arms, when we know that there are radically different interpretations of what that might mean, I think, at least interpretations under the federal equivalent. If we apply the scrutiny that the board is being asked to apply to this measure, if we also apply it to those kinds of measures, if those kinds of things were to be proposed by citizens today, the implication would be that citizens can't do that through the initiative process, that they can't submit general legal principles that might require interpretations, and that does trouble me to come to that conclusion.
I guess I would argue that this differs. Obviously, I have to argue that this differs. I think what I have proposed are sort of two, for example, diametrically opposed interpretations, absolutely opposite interpretations, both of which are supported by the language. For example, in Article 2, Section 10, no law shall be passed impairing the freedom of speech. We can argue about exactly what freedom of speech is. And I'd argue, for example, in here, I've not focused on the issue of a mineral extractor. We can argue about what a mineral extractor is. But I argue there's sort of a core definition or core sense of, what that means. And maybe at some point a fuzzy line as to what a mineral extractor is or not. Same within freedom of speech. But with respect to the issue of shall paying the fair value brought about, and there can be radically different interpretations. exactly what that means. There is no sort of core and penumbra. I mean, there are sort of different cores out there, depending on which one you happen to choose on that particular day. So that's how I would argue this differs.
There is, and one other thing I'll just comment on. I guess, again, this is probably not a question, but I know sometimes it looks like the board uses the language of a measure because of difficulties of understanding the measure any better. In this particular case, I don't think this is a case where the board is using the language of the measure because it's throwing up its hands, unable to do any better because it doesn't understand it. I think the board is using the language of the measure because altering that would likely mislead people. We would likely, because this is a general statement of principle, if we use, or to the degree we use different language, I suspect we would likely mislead voters about the true meaning and intent. I think that risk would be very real. So here I feel like I kind of understand, I believe, the general principle of this measure states. I share lots of questions that you've raised and that actually Mr. Wonstolen raised very well last time as well. Lots of questions, but it does seem like it's understandable. I don't think we're just totally at a loss of trying to understand what this is about. It's not that kind of situation. But anyway, that's kind of where I am right now.
I understand. Thank you for your patience.
Okay. Thank you.
My comments.
Mr. Wonstolen, I don't have you signed up, but if you'll sign up at some point, why don't you go ahead and come forward?
I appreciate the board's indulgence. Ken Wonstolen, appearing pro se. Mr. Chairman, I heard you say that you understand this measure to state a general principle. I think that's where I would challenge your analysis. What is the general principle? There is a body of law today that describes the damages for which mineral extractors of some sort are liable. Those are damages which result from the unreasonable use or exercise of the mineral right, negligent fashion, exceeding the scope of the mineral right and constituting trespass, failure to accommodate competing surface uses. I don't know that this measure changes that at all. I mean, some of my members argue this measure simply restates existing law, common law, puts it into the Constitution. On the other hand, it seems to be the intent of the proponents to overthrow the common law and erect some new strict liability broad standard. But you have no way of knowing from the words of this measure itself whether you are voting to restate the common law in constitutional terms, or whether you are voting to overthrow the common law. I have simply no way of knowing that. I don't think you can set a title that explains to voters what are they doing. Are they restating common law, or are they overthrowing common law? I think that's the fundamental dilemma.
Thank you.
Good. I can also get you to
sign in. I think Mr. Kaufman was also signed up. Do you need to testify, or do you want to testify? Sure. You'll identify yourself for the record, please.
Don Kaufman, on behalf of the proponents and one of the proponents. The initiative's just one sentence long. When you approved a title, you excluded including oil and gas. The miners, one of their objections is they want that term included in its entirety. We think that by doing that, you would make the initiative abundantly clear. It is broad, it's not vague, and by striking terms, all you would do is potentially increase the vagueness. All we ask is the entire sentence be included in the title.
Domenico?
Nothing.
Oh, sorry. I don't know whether you want to make a comment about the Mr. Wonstolen's comment, but this is anything you say on the record here is a reflection of legislative intent.
Sure.
And I am kind of curious your response to Mr. Wonstolen's comment that one of the the problems is, in his view, that it's unclear whether the measure is restating common law or is it overturning existing law.
It would be overturning existing law, which was attempted in the state legislature. That measure did fail, and now it's an attempt to allow the voters to make that decision to overturn common law.
Thank you. Having heard from each of the petitioners on the, behind the motions for rehearing, if anybody else wants to comment on what they've heard, before I turn to board discussion, I want to give you an opportunity. Mr. Gorman, do you have any further comments? Okay, thank you. Anyone else? Then I'll turn to board discussion on the motions for rehearing. Leslie, maybe if you would also project the title on the screen so that we can be looking at it as well. Thank you. Ms. Eubanks?
Got several issues here that have been raised in the motions for rehearing, and hopefully I'll touch upon all of them. Tell me if I miss one as we're going along. In terms of the argument that the measure is so ambiguous that we can't invade, that we can't set a title, I don't believe that's true. I'm like where you are, Mr. Hobbs. I think that we can ascertain what this measure does in terms of how it's implemented and who all it impacts. I'm not sure we're in a position to say. But I do know that the case law has clearly said that even if the terms of a proposal are vague and undefined, a title which tracks the language of a proposal accurately reflects the intent and central features of the proposal, although it may be similarly vague and undefined. I also recognize there is case law that goes forward that says that even if you track the language, that may not be sufficient if voters can't tell whether they're voting yes or no, if they don't know what they're voting on. I don't think we're there on this measure. I don't know, just from my expertise, I don't know whether this is a new standard of damages that have to be paid. I don't know if it's just putting in the Constitution the existing standard. I don't know that it matters, because I think what it does is it's setting a standard, whether that's the same standard or a new standard. It's setting a standard. It's telling the voters that if you vote for this, you're requiring extractors to pay damages for certain activities relating to mineral extraction. I think you can say yes or no whether they want to require that payment of damages. So I think I'm at the point right now that I think that we can set a title, and that the grounds raised in the motions for rehearing on this basis should be denied. In terms of the catchphrase argument about fair value, I think that this is a hard one. I think that it's, in some respects, I can see where the use of the term fair may be looked at, upon as being in some way intended to be influential, that, you know, fair damages versus unfair damages. I do think that it may be possible, because I think the term fair value goes to the amount of damages that is being required to be paid if this measure were to be approved, that perhaps we could remove that from the title, avoid the catchphrase potential problem, because you're saying that, you know, that it's requiring certain damages to be paid in relation to mineral extraction. And so I think that there may be some ways to address that concern, although I don't know that I'm entirely convinced that it is a catchphrase. I think we may be able to avoid the problem. I think there was anything else. I think I've touched upon yes or no. In terms of oil and the oil and gas, I think we probably just used the term mineral because we thought that was all inclusive. I think the language and the measure is there as just further elaboration of what is included in that term, but it's not exclusive to oil and gas. But I don't know that I have a problem adding that if it helps in terms of the clarity of the title. So I think that's where I am on the various issues.
Mr. Domenico?
I think I'm about in the same place. I should say I appreciate Mr. Gessler's explanation of the framework of analysis. I think he's correct, and late at night last week we probably got a little bit jumbled in our analysis, but I do appreciate that the question of whether we can ascertain the meaning of a measure is the first question and is separate from whether it's a single subject. And so I wanted to just state that I think that that's really the question we're having. That said, I think, as has been pointed out by everyone, there is essentially some the case law is difficult to ascertain a single definition or even perfectly consistent within the Supreme Court's jurisprudence in this area. It's a little bit difficult to come up with a single principle that helps us decide what's too vague and what's not. And but to the extent I've been able to see something in there, it's on both vagueness questions and catchphrase questions. The real basis for the court overturning a title on that basis is if use of vague terms is somehow misleading, or use of a catchphrase misleads voters into voting for something for voting for something because it's a catchphrase when the actual effect would be something different from their understanding. And I don't think that's a problem on either count in this case. I think to the extent fair value is a catchphrase, I don't think it's a misleading one. It's in the measure itself. While people may have some differences of opinion about what exactly fair value is, I don't think it's misleading to use it. And I don't think it's the kind of emotional thing where people will think they're voting for one thing but getting something else. And for the reasons I expressed before, I think we can understand what's going on here is the people would be voting on whether to put into the Constitution a number of undefined terms that would have to be fleshed out in the future. And I think while we may question some of those terms and how they may come out in the end, I think we can ascertain that as the intent and immediate direct effect of the measure. And so I think we can set a title. And I think we should go ahead and add the oil and gas just to make it more complete and a little bit clearer. But I do think we're able to set a title.
And I agree with Ms. Eubanks and Mr. Domenico, and I don't want to restate what I've already said before, but I think the board should proceed, and I think the titles that we've set are satisfactory, with the exception of we should add oil and gas at the end. I think, although Mr. Gorman indicated that the term mineral includes oil and gas, and I think that's what we were thinking when the board met before. When I actually look up the term mineral in the dictionary, it implies to me that it does not include oil and gas, that the dictionary definitions seem to say a solid, an inorganic solid, and things that to me suggest that it's not necessarily oil and gas. So I feel like we're the titles are a little misleading right now by not reflecting the fact that the measure also applies to oil and gas extraction. So I guess I would just, for the sake of discussion, make a motion that at the end, where Ms. Gomez has the cursor, that we insert a comma and add including oil and gas.
I would second that motion.
Been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. I have struggled a little bit about the catchphrase argument, too, but I think I'm, again, where Ms. Eubanks and Mr. Domenico are. I think that the titles are okay by referencing fair value at this point. Are there any other changes to the titles as set by the board? If not, I would entertain a motion to deny the various motions for rehearing, except to the extent that the board has amended the titles. Ms. Eubanks?
I would move that the title board deny the motions for rehearing in terms of all the grounds raised, except for the grounds raised in terms of the inclusion of the term including oil and gas at the end of the title.
I'll second the motion.
That's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That concludes action on number 125. The time is 10:22 a.m. Pardon?
Yeah, just go ahead.
Next, we'll go to number 3. Is that all right? Unless we want to, well, unless we can do number 5 or number 6, let's find out. Let me ask if anybody would be inconvenienced. I want to figure this out. If we went out of order and took item number 6 on our agenda, number 109, and I'm asking because Ms. Eubanks and Mr. Domenico are otherwise going to be have to go somewhere else for a while we do the other agenda items, but we could go ahead and take those up. Any objection from anybody in the room?
You know, I don't have any objection, Mr. Chairman. I don't know. I'm here on that.
Okay.
But,
let's see.
Mike Borkman is in the room.
I think we should just go in order. Since they're not here.
Since it possibly the proponents are relying on the agenda, we don't know that, but let's just stick to the order that we've got. So, thank you.
Well, two of them are kind of the same.
Your analysis pretty much coincided.
I'll tell you.
You know, particularly in the set of cases, Craig even refused to clarify. And the court said, you know, there's a real difference between, you know, looking at the ultimate effect of the measure and trying to figure out what the measure is about, you know, the substance of it.
Are you recycling or should I just throw them away?
Oh, no problem.
Hi, Maury.
Hey, Dan.
Can
Very good. You know, we also won the land use one. Mr. Hayes got an order on it. It wasn't an unpublished decision. It was just an order.
Pass that down.
But there's some hanging out there.
Okay, let's resume. I'd like to take up the next two agenda items together, perhaps. This is, we have a motion for rehearing submitted by Mr. Ed Ramey on behalf of Nora Bashir in the case of both number 122 and 123, which are somewhat similar. Our discussions, we may have separate discussions, but I think we could take them up together. For the record, the time is 10:26 a.m., and now sitting on the board as the designee of the Director of Office of Legislative Legal Services is Dan Carton, Deputy Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services. And then the representative of the Attorney General is now Jason Dunn, Deputy Attorney General. So, Mr. Ramey, I guess I'll turn to you, and if you could address your motions for rehearing, please.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. This time, Mr. Gessler and I disagree. It's the day changes. I think just for the sake of brevity, and taking these two together makes a lot of sense, there is one jurisdictional issue that we've raised that has to do with 123, and that's a single subject issue. And it's this, and I can't cite you case law one way or the other on it. It's a simple question of whether you can amend the state constitution and the Colorado revised statutes in one initiative. As simple and straightforward as that, I'm just going to leave that question with the board. I don't have authority to cite one way or the other. There may be authority that I'm not aware of, but it's certainly a question I think that we need to address, is whether amending those two completely different levels of law can be done as part of a single subject. Everything else we've raised are fairly specific items, and I've set them forth in here, and I don't want to consume the time of the board just reiterating them. I'm happy to answer any questions or clarify what the dickens I was trying to ineptly say in one or another of these items, but and they're pretty much the same, perhaps with one exception, between 122 and 123, items that I think are important that do need to be disclosed in some fashion in the title. And I'll just stop with that. However the board wishes to proceed. And I know also Mr. Gessler may have, has a copy of this he received, I hope, last night, and may have some manners in which he wishes to address or not address some of the items we've raised. I'll leave it completely to the board on that.
Thank you, Mr. Ramey. And I think the motions for rehearing are pretty clear, although we haven't had them for very long, of course, because of the press of time. I think they are very clear and well done. Let me just see if there are questions from the board on your motions for rehearing. Are there any questions, Mr. Dunn?
Hi, Mr. Ramey.
On your point number one.
Are we in 122 or?
I'm sorry, yeah, 122.
Okay.
Which I guess is number two on 123. The title is misleading because it does not clearly disclose the prohibitions of deductions for government employees' wages of dues or other monies applies to the use of such monies for federal and local as well as state political purposes. I'm wondering if that's true in the federal context, because the provisions, the terms that it defines are defined specifically in the context of Article 28.
I agree with you that if you look at the measure and look at the definitions and then look at where those definitions lead you, you can definitely, and I think should reach the determination of federal elections are included. My concern is with the title. I don't think it's clear from the title that there is an impact on federal campaign or money flowing into federal campaigns. You're absolutely correct, I believe, in your interpretation of the measurements.
Okay, maybe Mr. Gessler, when he comes up, he can address that as well. I don't know if it's easier to take these point by point or jump around. Or
well, maybe point by point, because I was coming at that particular point from a little different direction, which was the measure itself doesn't, to me, indicate that it's limited to state elections. And nor should the titles do that. That I actually was assuming it. What it prohibits is basically deductions for political purposes, and without regard to what political purposes really, federal, state, or local is where I was coming from. Now the question of whether in the Campaign Finance Act or in Article 28 of the Constitution, the state can do that. I would speculate, yes, because that this is a regulation not in an area that is governed by federal law. This is a wage deduction regulation, and that it probably could apply to federal purposes as well. I don't know that. I
think you're right, Mr. Pops. I mean, not to interrupt, but I don't see any problem with the measure doing what it purports to do with regard to wage deduction money going into federal elections.
Mm-hmm.
Again, my concern is that I think most people view, when they see something for political purposes, there is a distinction in their minds between federal and state, because most laws seem to be divided in that fashion. And I guess all I'm suggesting here is there should be clarity in the title that federal elections are included. I'm certainly not saying that it can't be done. I think it can be done, and I think, as Mr. Dunn said, the measure doesn't. But I don't think that jumps out of the title at you. And,
well,
and the natural reaction to this title is state elections.
And that's helpful. I mean, I'm probably coming at it from a different angle, that although those of us who face these issues all the time probably naturally think about distinctions between federal and state, for example, in particular, and sometimes state versus local elections, to the common citizen, when there's a prohibition on deductions for political purposes, I'm not sure that they're as sensitive to those distinctions, but appreciate the argument.
I think this is one of the downsides to getting this an hour before I come over. But
I apologize.
It's sort of some technical issues we were having, and I think that makes a little more sense. I agree with Mr. Hobbs. I'm not sure the average voter understands that distinction, and just kind of re-looking at the title as it refers to any candidate, political party, political committee, issue committee, or other political purpose. I think the average voter would understand that to affect both federal and state, I guess, as well as local races.
So, Mr. Dunya, on the other points I think you wanted to raise, or at least discuss.
Okay. He has anything on
that? Mr. Carden, did you have anything on that point?
No.
Okay. And Mr. Ramey, I think the second point on number 122, I mean, again, I'm just for the benefit of discussion, maybe I'll go ahead and suggest some places, kind of where I am on some of these, to generate some discussion. I appreciate the argument. I think the board struggled a little bit last time. Do we specifically mention labor organizations? The measure does. And that's significant, that there is an impact, I think, as I recall, on labor organizations. The way the board resolved it last time, which I'm still satisfied at this point with, is that it really applies to all organizations, deducting revenue, compensation for political purposes. Labor organizations, even if the measure didn't mention them, would be covered by the language of the measure, as I recall anyway. So I think we were reluctant to single out labor organizations, and at least felt that it was unnecessary.
That was the item, Mr. Hobbs, that I recall was discussed at some length last time. Struggled with that, and I'm raising it again.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't raise it, I think, last time, but I'm raising it here because I think the whatever generated that discussion last time and precipitated it, I think was a good point in that the measure, for whatever reason, and I defer to the proponents with regard to why, but the measure certainly goes to some effort to single out labor organizations and focus a light on them. And I'm just suggesting that the title should as well, though I certainly recall the discussion and understand the inclusion in the board's discussion last week.
And you concurred with, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Go ahead. And you concurred with that discussion last week, if you recall, that would fit under G, under subpart 2G.
Let me find the...
Yeah, in the measure itself. When it says a person or organization that spends or collects money for a political purpose.
I have no argument with the board's conclusion that, in fact, the measure is broader than labor organizations. My concern is that, again, for whatever reason, I don't mean to interpret the text, but labor organizations are focused on it. It seems to me if the text chooses to focus on them, either out of redundancy or for a particular purpose, that there's a reason that should be reflected in the title. And it's not hard to do it. It's not like the title needs to be turned upside down to accomplish that.
As I understand point number three, I think the concern there is that it may not be understood that the measure applies not just to candidates, basically, but also issues. Is that the gist of it?
The concept of electioneering communications.
Oh, that's right.
And similar messages are important. I mean, there's this weird phenomenon of what an electioneering communication is. And as I'm sure the board is aware, what it is under both state and federal law is a message having to do, perhaps legitimately, perhaps not so, with an issue of some sort, and it could be something other than a ballot issue, therefore unrelated to the sorts of things that issues committees do. It could have to do with something as broad as Colorado's environment or surface rights for dealing with mineral extraction, I guess. I don't know, but any issue you want to name. And if a message references a clearly identified candidate for election for whatever either candid or surreptitious purpose, depending on the time frame when it comes out, it could be an electioneering communication. Those things are scooped in here, and voters may not necessarily know that this sort of communication falls within the definition of political purpose. And again, it's just something that I think can be done. I don't quibble with the ability of the measure to do that. It's just that these it's an important item included in the measure. I think that should be reflected in the title. But again, easy to do. It doesn't take lines of additional language to the title. It takes words.
Again, I guess my reaction to that is the same as point number one, is that the those of us who are maybe deal with these issues more deeply are perhaps too sensitive to electioneering versus et cetera, whereas the common voter is probably going to be thinking political purpose is political purpose. That it might be unnecessary to get into that level of detail. But
I'm not sure if a message. If a message were to come out about how important it is to preserve Colorado's environment, and in the context of that message, thank Senator the wonderful work they've done.
I see.
Yeah. That be by the average voter as a political purpose. Might depend on whether so-and-so was standing for election or not, and what time of year that message came. I mean, the easy way to address it is just reflect it in time. And it is what it is.
Okay, Mr. Dunn?
Does the... inserting the phrase electioneering communication get us any closer?
I may defer to Mr. Gessler's suggested resolution of this problem. I'm not sure it does get us much closer. It gets us some closer because those words have meaning, but Perhaps a little more needs to be said than that. Number four makes sense. I mean, the concern is there something that is at least arguably completely unrelated to political purposes. If I'm reading the measure correctly,
well,
being corrected, that's included within that.
I'm not 100% sure I understand that one, so maybe we should discuss that.
I'm looking specifically at Roman numeral 2, E Roman numeral 2, which is defining political purpose. One of the measures in there says involves expenditures relating to an office described in subsection E1, which is, I guess, any of those listed of offices, which, if incurred by the individual, would be allowable as an ordinary and necessary business expense paid or incurred in carrying on a trade or business. Now, I'm not sure I do understand what that phrase means. I really am going to have to defer to the proponents on that. But whatever that means, it seems to me like it's something that's going beyond political campaigns. It may be referring, I don't know, to things like office accounts and that sort of thing. I don't know. But whatever that phrase means seems to extend a bit beyond what the average citizen would, what I would view as necessarily related to a political campaign.
Well, and I appreciate that because I guess I am a little confused myself about that portion of the measure, why there is a reference to ordinary and necessary business expenses, et cetera. And yet, when I look at it in context, you know, it refers back to the paragraph above it. It still all seems, which is the definition of political purpose, it still seems to be in the context of expenditures for political purpose. So,
is it a political purpose? I mean, if it includes office accounts, for example, can that be remotely a political purpose? I don't generally view that sort of thing as a political purpose. Perhaps the proponents do. Perhaps that's not even what they intend to include in there. I'm not sure. I guess I just don't know what that means.
Okay.
It's my frustration, but whatever it is ought to be reflected. Perhaps we'll get a little legislative history here this morning and ask them.
Okay.
On number five, I'm looking for that provision, which is the affirmative authorization.
Subsection 3.
It is. Yes, subsection 3, a state or local government may deduct from the wages of its employees dues or other monies that are not to be used for a political purpose. Well, here's an affirmative authorization. I'm not sure it's inconsistent with the present law, but I'm not sure that affirmative authorization in one of these, 123 at least, at the constitutional level, we're now enshrining an affirmative authorization of a deduction statutorily in one case, constitutionally in another. That I'm not sure appears anywhere else in law other than that it's not prohibited in law.
Which
isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah. I want to think that one through a little bit because, you know, my reaction to this portion of your argument was that it's not necessary for the titles to reflect that because that there is no prohibition. This doesn't appear to change current law, but at the same time, I think you correctly raise a point that I kind of want to think through. I mean, there is some case law applicable to the title board that constitutionalizing existing law is a change to the status quo, that it may be significant. Now, in checking my notes on that, My notes relate to a 2002 case, 46P3rd 438, that dealt with, I think, what was being constitutionalized in that case. In that case, as I recall, was that basically Tabor could not be repealed in a single measure. Now, that's something that I think was not obvious, if I'm correct on that, but the Supreme Court had previously pretty much said that, that probably was the law. There was previous case law to that effect. And the measures, I recall, was, I mean, I think this is a quote, proponents wish to constitutionalize the rule that Tabor may not be repealed wholesale, et cetera. To me, that's a little different here because that was maybe uncertain, and that principle that Tabor could not be repealed in a single measure, that was perhaps uncertain, except to the extent that the court indicated, possibly in dicta, I'm not quite sure what the status of it was, but indicated that probably could not be done in a single measure under the single subject requirement. So in that context, the court was saying constitutionalizing a rule
was a change.
A change to the status quo. And it still seems to me maybe this is different here, because here there was no, I don't know that there's any uncertainty. There's no prohibition. There's no single subject rule. There's no affirmative law out there that's questionable. Rather, this is simply why couldn't this happen? And the measures, to the extent that it's just saying that it can, I'm not sure. Again, I'm going around in circles here, but I don't see any change. I'm not sure it's a significant feature.
You know, and I understand your point, Mr. Hobbs, and this is one of those things where I don't know the answer to that. And I'm less bothered in the statutory form, which is 122, mm-hmm. than I am in the constitutional form. I mean, when we create a constitutional right, which I would probably substantively be supportive of, it's not something that I'm objecting to, but if we create a constitutional right that says a state or local government may deduct from the wages of its employees dues or other monies that are not to be used for political purpose and enshrine it as a constitutional measure, I'm not sure that that doesn't have some implications with regard to the ability, for example, the legislature in the future to prohibit certain kinds of deductions that may go to criminal enterprises or heaven knows what else, because now we've got this constitutional right sitting up there. I doubt that's what the proponents intend, but there's that provision, and it is an affirmative statement in 123 at a constitutional level. And again, I'm not saying it can't be done. Whatever it means, whatever its intent is, I'm not sure it can't be done, but it could be extremely important. Much more in 123, I think, than 122.
Okay, well, that's helpful. Appreciate that.
And all I'm saying is, again, that's something that belongs in the title. Now, perhaps there's a single subject issue implicit in there that I've neglected to raise, if in fact the intent is as broad as one might fear. But at least it ought to be in the title.
Okay.
Number six, I think, was an issue that the board also dealt with last time. Issue committee was moving in and out of the title and so forth. But there are other organizations other than the enumerated creatures of Article 28 that are covered in here. I assume this would cover 527 organizations. Depending on the meaning of that provision we talked about a few moments ago regarding ordinary business expense, it may cover 501c4s, which one would not generally view as political organizations. Perhaps other ones. I don't know. But it's a whole lot more than political committees.
Okay.
And then number seven, I guess, is just the we've debruced.
Mm-hmm. And I do have a problem with that one. In thinking about that, I mean, subject to what else I hear this morning, I think we do need to reflect that. I think that is something that probably the titles need to reflect, that the fines are exempt from the revenue and spending limitations.
And when the board was beating me to death on another initiative last week, I think in the titles that we were looking at there, we did have that measure. We accepted circumstances. And I guess I'm agreeing with you, Mr. Hobbs, that Tabor, for whatever, and its limits, for whatever it may be worth, whatever good or bad it may be doing, certainly is a prominent fixture on the landscape. And if we're undoing a piece of it, which may be, again, a good thing to do, it should be in the title, so the voters know.
I mean, I don't know that the fines are significant. I mean, I guess the argument on the other side is the fines may be minimal, this is very minor. But at the same time, I think that is a separate and distinct feature here, that whether the fines end up being a large sum of money or very small, I think you're right, in my opinion, that this is something that the public is pretty sensitive to, having just voted on referendum C and being aware of those issues. To whatever extent a measure exempts some source of revenue from this revenue spending limitations, I think that needs to be pointed out. But I want to get Mr. Gessler's reaction to that, too. But
I'm sure he's going to have a wealth of reactions, too, in discussing.
Okay.
I think there is only one other item during the 123. I think we've covered virtually all of them except the single subject issue, which is just what I stated. And there is one other, and that is number 9, which is simply the disclosure of the issue that poses a single subject issue. The aspects of the proposed initiative would be effectuated through a constitutional amendment, and which aspects would be effectuated through the Colorado revised statutes. Deem that can be done. I think every other item that we've raised with regard to 123.
And let me just comment on that, kind of where I am at this point. I mean, You did raise sort of a general question as well. I mean, is there anything about a measure that it amends both the Constitution and the statutes? And I think we've had those before. I don't recall arguments that this is inherently problematic, amending both the Constitution and the statutes. And I don't recall what those... It hasn't happened very often. We just had one recently, as a matter of fact, and I can't remember what it was. I just don't recall anyone raising an issue on that, and maybe somebody will refresh my memory here. But I'm having trouble seeing that that's inherently a problem, if there truly is one subject. Sometimes, I at least conceptually can see that in order to address a single thing, like campaign finance, for example, you might, which has both constitutional and statutory provisions, you might need to amend both. A proponent might need to.
I don't recall in campaign finance that it was done that way.
Right. No, I'm not saying it was. I can't remember where I've seen this before. I do know we set a title, and I think it was last time.
Probably one of my initiatives. Sure, I hope not.
And the title start out, normally we say either amending the Colorado Constitution or amending the Colorado Revised Statutes. We actually had to change the staff draft to say amending the Colorado Constitution and the Colorado Revised Statutes.
I think it was this one.
Was it?
I think it was this one.
Okay, I'm this one. That's exactly then, I guess, what it is. So I.
Maybe it was this measure.
So that is not persuasive at all, because.
Yeah, you've done it, right?
But I do recall that it's happened before, and I just don't recall any, and I may be wrong, but Mr. Kneiser, do you remember?
There have been some that have amended the Constitution, and in the context of that provision, there were also measures or statements that statutory provisions to the contrary are repealed or amended. That's about the closest I can come to.
And I can't cite you authority either, because my sense is, if it has been done, an objection wasn't raised. And, of course, objection isn't raised on single subject grounds. There's no sort of post-adoption single subject challenge that can be brought. I think the Supreme Court has said that. I pose the question, I guess, at two levels. I mean, number one, if you're going to do it, I guess at three levels. Number one, if you're going to do it, recite that you're doing it. And you have done that. The board has done that in the title to 123. Number two, perhaps it's important to disclose which aspects apply to which amendment, where the Constitution is being amended and what way the statute is being amended. And number three, the underlying question is there a single subject issue? And I guess I would pose the question at least for argument's sake, that if one is amending the Constitution of this state, somehow that ought to be inherently a different subject, even if the subject matter is the same as the statute that's being concurrently amended, because one is the Constitution and one is the Code of Revised, or the Colorado Revised Statutes. I can't cite you a single case one way or the other on that. And I think you're correct, Mr. Hobbs. I doubt that that's been fleshed out, particularly at the Supreme Court level. And if it had, Mr. Kneiser would be citing the case to us, I'm sure. So I defend them all. So,
well,
I'm just not aware of any.
Trying to think that through, you know, I think you're right. I can see how this could be a problem. And although it's not exactly on point, you know, the measure that we had last time that did deal with campaign finance, I think the board did struggle a little bit with the fact that the constitutional provisions, so much of the constitutional provisions were being wiped out with the idea that they'll be replaced. The General Assembly was being authorized, as I recall, to enact them in statute, and that's very significant. And we struggled a little bit with the titles on how to properly reflect that, about what was being retained and what was being, could be enacted statutorily and so forth. But you're correct. It wasn't a situation where the measure itself was attempting to enact both constitutional and statutory provisions. Now, in a way, Amendment 27 did that. It was purely constitutional, but it included provisions that expressly repealed statutes, as I recall. But again, that's not a good analogy either, because it did not expressly. Well, it didn't. I don't know. Maybe that is a good analogy.
Well, I don't. My recollection of what I'm thinking of is Article 28 as it appears now. What I don't recall about Amendment 27 was whether it contained repealers in it or whether it simply overrode statutory provisions. I don't recall the answer to that, but I think.
And I wanted to look that up because it may end up not being very helpful, but. My recollection is that it put into the Constitution statutory provisions that it wanted to repeal. At the end, Article 28, Section. Section 12 says sections 1-45-103, 145-1. I mean, it has a list. It says those sections are repealed.
But there was a repealer in those statutory sections. I don't recall if that issue was. Two responses to that. One, I don't recall if that issue was raised, repealing a statute in a constitutional provision. Perhaps it should have been. Secondly, I'm wondering if there's a distinction between just a straight repealer and what's done here. I don't know. I raise the question because I don't think there's any definitive authority on this. At some point, I would think, notwithstanding a connectivity of substance and subject, wading into both the Constitution of this state, which involves, we talked about a while ago, enshrining provisions at a level. Some control over the legislature, for example, and tinkering with the statute, kind of inherently different activities.
Not to
maybe
blame.
That's something we need to litigate and figure out, get some pronouncement on at some stage. I don't know.
Just one last point, and then in this particular case, it strikes me that this issue may not, although it conceptually could be important. I'm not sure it is here because the Section 2 of the measure that amends the statute, it looks to me like it's kind of like a minor technical or conforming amendment that I'm not even sure is necessary. I mean, it's referring, the statute that it's amending says nothing in this article shall prevent or prohibit the use of checkoffs, et cetera. So the proponents here have said, well, except as provided in our measure. That might be the case, even if they didn't bother to try to make that what might be a minor technical amendment to the statutes. That might be the the true anyway, because the constitutional provision would prevail, perhaps.
I don't think I would argue that point. But for whatever reason, again, the proponents elected to do it, even if the effect of the constitutional amendment would have been to accomplish that. And I guess my concern is if you elect to do it, rather than the board trying to figure out why and how important or not important is it, the point is you wade it into another body of law that did so.
Okay.
And I do think, by the way, it is, this and also the related point, it does get a little dangerous, I think, for us in this context and the board to start trying to figure out how important is this, and what did the proponents intend, and do they mean something more broad-sweeping than we're guessing they might mean, and is it ministerial or not? I'm not sure that's a discussion that we ought to be having in this context. The proponents elected to do it. They thought it was important enough to do it, and that ordinary necessary business expense issue being similar, they thought it was important enough to do it. I think we need to accept that. Important.
Okay. Mr. Carton?
Just in connection with this discussion, I think it's an issue worth raising. I guess that kind of my take on it would be that as far as it being a single subject question, we have a fairly recent pronouncement by the Supreme Court on the single subject requirement, relative to the single subject requirement in the title on 2005-2006 number 73, where the
Thank
court
you, Mr.
didn't mean to. It is recent, Mr. Ramey. Where the court said the single subject requirement is not violated if the matters encompassed are necessarily or properly connected to each other rather than disconnected or incongruous. Said another way, the single subject requirement is not violated unless the text of the measure, quote, relates to more than one subject and has at least two distinct and separate purposes which are not dependent upon or connected with each other. And so I guess I would just say a couple things. First, I would agree with, well, I don't know if this is exactly what Mr. Hobbs said, but I do think that the amendment to the statute in 123 is in the nature of a conforming amendment, and I think that would have is a factor in this particular analysis. I think that the amendment to the statute and the Constitution in 123 are connected, are congruous. I'd also say under 140.106.53, that's the section that generally says that the title board should follow the same rules employed by the General Assembly in considering titles for bills. And so I think, again, I'm going to be kind of vague on this, but I think that the title board has or has had before it a measure where there was an amendment to the Constitution and an amendment to the statute. And I believe also, although I can't cite you, that the General Assembly has had referred measures before it that amended the Constitution and amended the statute. And I think that it would be my take that if that kind of a measure before the General Assembly otherwise met the general rule for single subject, that the fact that the measure amended both the Constitution and the statute wouldn't raise a single subject issue. My story, you know.
I think you've stated the issue well. We have a dearth of authority, and I think we all understand
that's true.
The issue.
Right.
The board's got.
And
to
I would
jump.
Agree with that too. There's not much there to.
The board's got to jump one way or the other on that, and at some point, I suppose we need some clarification to that.
If there aren't any other questions, oh, Mr. Dunn.
Can we go back to, I didn't sort of
touch on briefly, but number six, I'm not sure I fully understand.
Number six in 122, right?
Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
Okay. Oh, okay. The title for 122 refers specifically to candidates, and I think the board at the last hearing said that logically, it's candidate committees. Political parties, political committees, issue committees, or other political purpose. given the breadth, at least that I'm reading in the measure, which goes in part to that issue about ordinary necessary business expense, but also even short of that, there are other kinds of organizations which are none of those things, which are clearly affected, if not potentially affected by this. For example, I think 527 organizations, what we classically call ed funds, are clearly within the scope of this. 501c4 organizations may, depending upon the meaning of that other provision, appear to me to be within the scope, at least for some situations of this measure. Perhaps other organizations, C3s, I don't know. I don't know how broadly to read that one provision that we're discussing. But it's more than candidate committees, political parties, political committees, and issue committees.
And why wouldn't they fall into the other political purpose catch-all?
There are two questions, I think, implicit in what you just said. Number one is, what other political purpose? I think this goes beyond that. It appears to me to be picking up sorts of things that C4s would do that are not necessarily within the context of a political purpose. But also, you've enumerated a group of organizations which sort of suggests what a political purpose is. And there are other kinds of identifiable operative organizations out there. And I mean, take an easy example of education funds, clearly intended to be included. And they ought to be referenced. Their exclusion from the title, I think, suggests an exclusion. And the measure clearly scoops them in. I'm not going to quibble with candidate committee, but these other organizations, I think do it. And again, the difficulty I'm having is I'm not sure how broad, Mr. Dunn, my argument is going here, because on the one hand, I think ed funds are clearly intended to be included. I'm not sure that's clear from the title. That's one level of what I'm suggesting. If my reading, subject to being corrected in a few moments by the proponents, but perhaps not, because I mean, if I'm reading it the way I'm reading it, others may read it the same way. If my reading is correct in that, is that this goes beyond what most of us would view as a political purpose, which is a candidate or ballot issue. This may extend to organizations that I generally view as wholly unrelated, or at least to some degree unrelated to political purposes, like what a 501c4 issue, I don't mean ballot issue, but broad issue type organization may be expounding or educating upon. They may be picked up.
Because that organization wouldn't fall into the technical definition of an issue committee, is that why?
Well, if that organization is contributing to an office account or assisting with some sort of a legislative function unrelated to a political campaign, if I'm reading that one provision as broadly as it seems to read, a 501c4, for example, and perhaps other organizations, I don't know, would be scooped within reach of this article. I'm going to have to defer. I'm stumbling a little bit because I don't know what that provision means. I'm going to have to defer to the proponents as to what the dickens they intend by that language. But whatever it is, I think it's susceptible to a broad reading, and whatever reading it is susceptible to ought to be reflected in some fashion. I'm not suggesting there's a single subject issue here, but whatever that is, there's a broader scope of organizations that are, I think, pretty clearly subject to impact by this, other than the clearly campaign-related organizations that are listed. And there should be some suggestion of that in the title.
Okay.
Again, I'm stumbling and not being very clear because I can't get my arms around what the real intended and ultimate scope of that one provision in particular might be.
I may be off base here, but I think what I'm hearing is that your concern partly has to do with the enumeration of the political entities, and that the reader of the titles reading that list, candidate, political party, political committee, et cetera, reading it in context, they get to other, and it says, or other political purpose, they might think that it's those kinds of things that the measure is about, when in reality it's probably broader than that.
A lot broader than that, perhaps, yes.
Would it help, and I just, you know, I can think of a number of suggestions here that, that might help address that concern, but one of them would be, the simplest one would be to just say, instead of just say, or other political purpose, sort of break that up. And we've already said for the support of candidate, political party, political committee, we could say, or issue committee, and then say, or for the support of any other, or for the support of any political purpose.
That would address part of my concern.
Right.
Or other organizations that engage in activities with a political purpose. I think addresses part of it. My other concern, though, relates to the other objection, and that is the scope of this thing seems to go broader than what I normally view as a political purpose. Political generally, to me, suggests a campaign of some sort, at least loosely affiliated with what's going on. Perhaps an issue, ballot issue campaign, perhaps a candidate campaign, but a campaign. And I'm reading this measure, again, subject to correction to some degree by the proponents, but I think the language is susceptible to this reading, clearly, as going beyond political purposes into something else. And in that, as that meaning expands, which itself needs to be reflected, the types of organizations it impacts expands as well. And they're not just ones that are connected to a political purpose. I don't know if those two, if that distinction is clear about.
I think I understand. So. Any other questions for Mr. Ramey? If not, then Mr. Gessler?
Here come all the answers.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. My name is Scott Gessler, and I represent the proponents in this matter. Probably start with one of the last points, or the other political purpose. I think the problem with the argument by in the motion for rehearing is essentially what it asks this board to do is include other types of organizations or other potential types of entities. In other words, enumerate yet more. Yet we don't know when that enumeration should stop. I think that adds unnecessary detail here and does not add any clarity. Let me go back to the framework of the sort of the ordinary business expenses that Mr. Ramey seemed to focus on. As I said before, that language is drawn directly from Section 527 of the IRS Code, which is part of the term political, which defines a tax status, tax-exempt organization, entitled political organization. I think there's adequate sort of case law and regulatory guidance that this type of activity is a political activity, political purpose. What that normally refers to, and again, this is my interpretation of the 527 code, is office holders and candidates who engage in activities that normally would be considered business expenses. For example, and I think Mr. Ramey was correct in coming, perhaps their office accounts, as we use that term slang term in Colorado. My answer is yes, they are. Basically, for example, a office holder decides that he or she needs to visit constituents, gets in the car, gets in a plane to go to Durango, whatever. That costs money. They drive out there to talk to constituents about issues that are before the legislature. That would be encompassed in 527. And I think most people would agree that's a political purpose. You're out doing politics. In fact, we've seen this in Colorado here, and some of it's very controversial. I mean, for example, there's an organization called Research and Democracy, one that I would characterize as secretive and nefarious. But that said, what Research and Democracy did is it sent out, on behalf of candidates, flyers, which basically identified candidates in their office-holding capacity and communicated to voters what those office-holders / candidates' positions were on issues. Okay, that was treated as an office count contribution. The office holders reported it as part of their honorarium. Functionally, physically, if you looked at that, if piece of mail that went out. It's, in many instances, similar or identical to what we would call an electioneering communication on the eve of an election. So the same type of glossy piece of literature lauds a candidate, says this is what they're doing, great things in the legislature, or this is what their positions are. And most people would view that, regardless of what sort of tax box we fit it in, most people view that as that's a political thing. It's done for political purposes. So my point here is that what this does, the statute does, or I should say the proposal does, is it enumerates some types of actions that have already, some types of organizations that have already been defined in Colorado law as specific political entities. Okay? And the title properly says any monies that are used to support those political entities. Okay? But obviously Colorado law is not broad enough to incorporate every type to label and identify and regulate every type of activity that can be considered political. So what we need to do is rely on a functional analysis or other political purpose. And that's exactly what this, what the title reflects and what this initiative does. The title reflects these types of action, these types of organizations that everyone agrees, I believe everyone agrees, are political types of organizations. And it also says support of other political, you know, other political purposes. Now, we can certainly, you know, discuss the IRS tax code and, you know, whether 501c4s engage in political activities and 501c3s. And the answer in both those instances is yes. I mean, a 501c4 can do it, provided it's not the primary purpose but a secondary service. A 501c3 can do it, provided it's sort of an issue committee type of activity, and that C3 is a public charity that produces appropriate public support, not a private foundation 501c3. So the answer to this, what these other organizations are or can be, is a complex answer, which would be impossible to capture by enumerating types of organizations in a ballot title. Also, you run into vagueness problems. An education fund. I do not know what an education fund is, and I defy anyone to tell me what an education fund is, okay, in a meaningful, objective manner that either has some, that doesn't refer to some type of organizational structure that fits into one of these tax boxes or political boxes. Okay? So I think the title is very accurate, and it reflects exactly what this initiative does, which is it enumerates types of organizations that are defined by an activity that most people recognize, a political committee. Obviously, it doesn't define what a political committee is. And it says a political purpose. And I think that's an idea that most people readily understand and is readily captured in this initiative. Talking about candidates and talking about issues that are connected to those candidates, both in the terms of a legislative issue connected to that candidate and in the terms of a ballot issue. And those are all what I think most people would consider politics. So, and to sort of loop back into this initiative, I'm sorry, the challenge to the initiative title. Basically, what a lot of the challenge is it says, well, the title board failed to include X, failed to include Y, failed to include Z, and, well, actually failed to include a lot of things. And to include all of these things would, I think, greatly expand this title, greatly increase the complexity. And there's a danger in that, because long, complex titles in and of themselves can become unclear just because there's so much for voters to grasp. And the Colorado Supreme Court has recognized that, which is why this board has a charge of brevity. I hope that answers the questions about the political purpose and how the ordinary business expense is directly connected to political purposes. Hearing silence, I guess, answer questions.
Mr. Cardin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gessler, I think I would agree with you that starting to enumerate 527s and 501c4s and the like may raise an issue as far as what is meant by 145, 119, subsection 2G, of the measure, which talks about a person or organization that spends or collects money for a political purpose. You said that to maybe to and I'm paraphrasing to elaborate on that would add inordinate detail and does not provide clarity. And my question to you would be, and this is kind of playing off of Mr. Hobbs's suggested language, my question is whether or not if in the current title to the measure where it currently says or other political purpose on line 4, if instead of saying or other political purpose it said or persons or organizations engaged in a political purpose or persons or organizations spending or collecting monies for a political purpose, whether that would add inordinate detail or fail to provide clarity.
I think it would be, we would not object to the language that said, or other persons or organizations engaged in a political purpose.
Thanks.
Okay. Before I say I wouldn't object, I need to think about that, but I think that begins to capture it. I mean, I would be concerned about collecting or spending money, because that doesn't quite capture what exactly a political purpose is, and it seems...
But it does, would you agree, it does accurately reflect the text of the measure, subsection 2G.
Yes, I would agree.
Thanks.
I would agree.
Let me ask a sort of a follow-up question and throw out maybe a more radical idea, too, and get your reaction to that. And it really focuses on that 2G. I'm wondering about whether it would make some sense for the board to amend the titles and just refer to, prohibiting deductions from employees' wages for the support of any political purpose. Just say for the support of any political purpose, eliminating the enumeration altogether.
I think that's a very accurate and brief way to write this, because it does focus on the fact that these are being used for political purposes, and many of these types of organizations are enumerations of that general rule.
I mean, the measure talks about. Who payments are made to, and that's kind of why we're in this discussion. There's a long enumeration. On the list it says that, shall not deduct wages to be paid directly or indirectly to all of, these political entities. But when it comes to 2G, it says a person or organization that spends or collects money for political purpose. Well, the person or organization part of it really is irrelevant. I mean, all the money is going to be paid to some person or organization. What 2G really says is it captures everything that's going on, regardless of who it's paid to, whether it's a small donor committee, issue committee, or whatever. What 2G means is that it can't be spent for political purposes, I think. So I'm just explaining why I think that may be confusing, in fact, to focus on candidate committees, issue committees, and so forth.
I'd agree, and and perhaps... In light of this discussion, perhaps a better way to have drafted this would have been to say no amount shall be paid directly or indirectly to a person or organization that spends or collects money for a political purpose, which shall include but not be limited to the following specific instances. Maybe it should have been written that way, but in order to reflect those comments. But I think that the meaning, the actual application and the meaning is the same. So I would have no objection to that, and I do agree that it removes a lot of the clutter, and it puts front and center the purpose of a single subject, to prevent these political purposes. So I like that suggestion.
Okay.
And would not object to it. I'd like to just point out a few other things. As far as the fact that it amends both the Colorado Constitution and a statute. Now, this is the single subject requirement, not the single statute requirement. And it was already discussed, you know, that Article 28 itself amended the Constitution and amended the Colorado Revised Statutes. I think really the central frame of reference is, you know, are they part of the same subject, not necessarily where are they located within a sometimes complex and cumbersome statutory and constitutional framework. With respect to the debrucing measure, I'd argue that is not a significant part of this. Sort of the history of it was that it initially didn't, you know, the review and comment session didn't actually include a debrucing measure. There were some substantive questions raised on that issue, so it was inserted along those lines, primarily for clarification's sake. The reason I don't think it's significant here is this is not intended, and in fact, it's not intended to be a meaningful revenue stream in any sense of the matter. In fact, if you look at the remedies, there's sort of two remedies. The main remedy is refund of monies. In other words, the state doesn't even keep the money. A fine is only paid if there's both if it's a knowing and willful violation. So in other words, it requires, you know, almost a specific intent to actually get this, to create fines. So it's not your normal civil fine procedure where it's almost a strict liability regimen. So for those reasons, I think it's insignificant. And we hopefully will not see a large revenue stream going to the state for this, but rather it'll affect refunds to employees whose wages are withheld for an improper purpose. And obviously will deter knowing and willful conduct.
Mr. Dunn?
It raises an interesting question, which I'm not sure is totally matters here, but if something is added in as a result of review and comment, is it at the petitioner's discretion to remove that from consideration on rehearing?
From the measure itself?
Correct.
I don't think so. I mean, I think
once they decide to add it in,
I think it's the measure before us. It wouldn't be a technical correction, but the only other method by which I can think of that a proponent could change the text submitted to the Secretary of State's office.
You're right.
And we're not trying to. The next point I'd make is with respect to the concern that this initiative may create new substantive rights. I'd direct the title board to the language itself. It says a state may withhold. Let me pull up the exact language. It says a state or local government may deduct from the wages of its employees dues or other monies. It does not say a state or local government shall deduct. This does not create a right on the part of a state or local government, or I should say, does not create a right for an individual to compel a state or local government to do something. It simply is a reflection of the current discretionary ability of state and local governments to do as they see fit. So it really is more of a clarification, say, to identify the limits of this particular statute rather than creating new substantive rights. And that's clear by the fact that it says may rather than shall. If the state decides that it wants to prohibit deductions for other reasons, you know, it still has that ability to do the prohibition. And if the state decides it wants to include other forms of deductions or pay for those transfers itself, it can still do that. And then I guess the final point, which really wraps into a lot of my earlier ones, enumerating, for example, that electioneering communications are a political purpose. I think that's a really good example of just the challenges of the whole enumeration business once we go beyond what's specifically in the text of the initiative. Do people know what an electioneering communication is? What point do we stop defining that? And then my final two points, with respect to initiative number 122, numbers 1 and 3, number one, for example, the title is misleading and it does not clearly disclose that the prohibitions basically apply to federal and local as well as state political races and political purposes. Mr. Hobbs, we would agree with you and your interpretation that this is focused on political, and it does not limit itself to state. I would, for what it's worth, sort of represent anecdotal evidence. I can't count the number of people I've asked, you know, because I sort of happen to be a political wonk. You ask someone, you know, who their state senator is, you know, for the state senate, and they say, well, that's Ken Salazar or Wayne Allard. And of course, you have to explain to them, no, that's a U.S. senator, that's not a state senator. So I think that the ability or the readiness of people to think about these things on an ongoing basis, a regular basis, and make the distinctions that we do is they just don't spend the type of time, and they clump this into political. Also, I'd like to point out that a similar measure to this, and I think I'd represented to the board that it was one last week was numbers 104, 105. In fact, I looked it up. It was a proposed initiative measure number 164. It surprised me that this year we're about 25% less than we were 2 years ago. But 2 years ago, it was initiative number 164. This exact same objection in almost identical language was brought before the Colorado Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court summarily affirmed the title board's decision not to include or to enumerate both federal, state, and local. So I think there's very strong case law on point. I apologize. I wasn't able to get the full briefings from the court in the time we had. And then with respect to item number 3, the title is misleading and it does not clearly disclose that the term political purpose includes electioneering communications. There was a similar objection in number 164 2 years ago as well. That particular proposal had used the term education committee and then defined education committee. The title did not enumerate education committee as one of the items. The objector said, well, it should have included that, should have specifically in the title said education committee. And again, the Supreme Court summarily affirmed the title board's decision to omit a specific enumeration or a specifically defined term because, and again, it was a summary affirmation, so the court didn't provide its reasoning. But I would argue that the reason they did it is because the term political purpose really incorporates all of these enumerated items. It incorporated education committee, and that was fairly accurate. Fair, it was accurate, and it was brief. So I think there's a very strong case law almost directly on point that allows the title board to avoid enumerating all potential instances. And
thank
I'm
you.
Happy to answer any other questions you may have.
Any questions for Mr. Gessler? Okay, thank you. Mr. Ramey, do you have any comments?
I don't think so. I would just be debating with Mr. Gessler.
Okay.
Or three of these points in particular. I think the issues are well elucidated. If the board has any questions either for me or Mr. Gessler,
thank you. I don't have anybody else signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on 122 and 123? If not, I'll turn to board discussion. Any discussion by the board? Mr. Carton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be brief. I think that there was a good discussion on objections 1, 2, and 3 in number 122. Based on that discussion and the basis that was set forth in the last title board meeting on number 122 for including the language in the title that is in the current title, I don't believe that the grounds in 1, 2, and 3, I don't think that the title is misleading because it does not include those particular items. And I would say that for number 4 as well. Number 5, I guess maybe depending on what the other board members want to do, maybe we can talk about whether or not the title of the constitutional amendment should have some language reflecting that. which I think can be described, if it's not an authorization, it is a, it is putting something into the law affirmatively. That, and then number six, I think you had a suggestion, Mr. Hobson, and I'd be willing to talk about that and perhaps modify the title to both, and I'm jumping ahead here, number 122 and number 123, as well as number 7 on the debrucing. I think you mentioned that it was your opinion here at least some 45 minutes ago that perhaps the title should reflect that fact, and I'd be supportive of that if you wanted to come up with some language.
Thank you.
Mr. Dunn, do you have any?
Yeah, I think I'd concur if I heard that correctly, that Mr. Carton was suggesting denying, at least in the context of 122, items 1, 2, 3, 4, and leaving 5, 6, 7 open for discussion. Maybe the place to start is to move to deny those requests for rehearing and then move on to 5, 6, and 7.
Or we could
just start with 5.
And then see if there's any changes and then do a motion that denies in all other respects.
Okay.
But I think we're pretty much in a similar position here. Want to take them in order. Number 5, you know, I think I have been kind of turned around on that one. I think given that there's now, well, I don't know about in the case of this 122, where we're not constitutionalizing that principle, I'm not sure that the titles need to be changed. But I think I'm turned around a bit with respect to 123, that where we are constitutionalizing the authority of state and local governments to make other deductions, any other deductions maybe, and then perhaps that would need to be reflected in our titles. But I don't know. How do the other board members feel about that?
I would agree within the context of 122 that I don't think we need to reflect that in the statutory context.
I'd agree with that.
Well, let's maybe focus on 122 for now. Sounds like number 5 we would not... Not much support for a change on 122. Point number 6. You know, for the sake of discussion, I mean, there's several ways to approach that. The simplest might be just to eliminate the references to candidate, political party, political committee, issue committee, and just. Refer to, I mean, in using existing language, refer to the support of any of, prohibiting any deductions by a state or local government from an employee's wages for any political purpose would be the simplest, the most economical in terms of words. Any concerns, Mr. Carton?
Mr. Chair, would it be appropriate to perhaps briefly have Mr. Ramey comment on that proposed change?
Mr. Ramey, would you like to comment on, I mean, that approach would simply just say, you know, it just simply refer to, you know, any political purpose and eliminate all the other references.
I think that for the purpose, this sort of gets to that multi-layered discussion we're having, I think that does address, candidly, part of our concern, and that extent we're dealing with organizations that have what is appropriately and colloquially viewed as a political purpose, which would include 527s for to a large degree, I think the title would be superior by adopting the amendment you're proposing. It doesn't get to the broader concern where you interrelate this question with point number 4, and this is one of the points where I'm sure Mr. Gessler and I can go around in circles for hours, but I would suggest that some of these things fall within the Internal Revenue Code definition that apparently is being incorporated in here would not be remotely viewed as having a political purpose because they're not connected in any way with the campaign, but that's that other level. So I think the language you're talking about improves the title. I don't think it solves all problems.
Thank you.
I guess my suggestion would be maybe eliminate the any, especially when you have, you know, for, just say for political purposes. And then I, you know, my motion I think is going to be then strike everything from where the cursor is down to the beginning of line 5 through purposes. And let me just read that to see if that makes sense.
You lost purpose.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So it should read, prohibiting any deductions by state or local government from an employee's wages for political purposes. Pardon?
My only comment or question would be whether or not that particular clause is any different from the language of the single subject, specifically where it reads. Do you understand my question?
Yeah, sure do.
And I mean, it is there because it says state or local government in the second, but, and that may be fine. I just raised the question.
Good question.
Can you repeat that?
The single subject of the measure says, concerning a prohibition on wage deductions by governments for political purposes. And then the proposed modified language says, in connection therewith, prohibiting any deductions by a state or local government from an employee's wages for political purposes. And my question at base is, what's the difference between those two clauses? I don't have a suggestion. I'm just shouldn't do that. I think it's fine. I guess I would say I'm pointing it out.
It, and I appreciate that. I think it's redundant. I don't actually have a suggestion either. I wish there were a simple solution to that. You know, I think we have to express this, clearly express the single subject. So we've said basically what it's fundamentally about, a prohibition on wage deductions for political purposes. We didn't say state and local because we try to avoid conjunctions in the statement of single subject. But after the in connection therewith, we try to enumerate the major features and end up being somewhat redundant, only saying that it applies to state and local governments is the only new information there. The other trailers provide a little more information, but I don't have a... I sort of feel like we're backed into it because of the requirement to clearly express a single subject. And
I'd second.
That's my motion. It's been seconded. Discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Further suggestions in response to the motion for rehearing? Mr. Carton.
In connection with objection number 7 of the motion on the debrucing, and you may have some language on for this, Mr. Chair, but perhaps adding language and exempting fine revenue from the revenue and spending limitations imposed by Article 10, Section 20 of the Colorado Constitution. That might be overkill, but I guess I might put that up there for beginners and compare it down.
Yeah, I might want to modify a little bit, but I think maybe right after we talk about imposing fines, after that semicolon and before the and, in middle of line 6, after the semicolon, I think is where we would start. We've just said imposing fines. And before we put it up, one issue I think is whether or not we refer to Article 10, Section 20. And this is a common dilemma we're in, that the reader may not know what that is. I wonder about maybe referring, instead of referring to Tabor or referring to Article 10, Section 20, if we just simply refer to constitutional revenue and spending limitations, exempting or excluding
exempting and fines from constitutional revenue and spending limitation.
That is adequate.
That's certainly acceptable.
So let's say I don't know, exempting. Correct me as I go here if I'm wrong here, Mr. Carden. Exempting such fines from constitutional revenue and spending limitations. Spending limit, revenue and spending limitations.
Do we need and spending?
Good question. I wanted to look at Tabor itself to think that through. I mean, Tabor talks about spending limitations. As I recall, for once maybe we won't depend on Ms. Eubanks to guide us through Tabor, but as I recall, in effect, it's a revenue limitation, but it uses the term spending limitation and talks about it in terms of... it defines fiscal year spending as expenditures and reserve increases, which effectively makes it a revenue limitation. But I think we have sometimes used this kind of phrase just to make sure we've covered our bases. It's really more of a revenue limitation. I mean, I think I agree with the idea that it may be sufficient to say revenue limitations, but I'm concerned about the fact that Tabor itself refers to it as a spending limitation.
Oh, I'm fine the way it is.
Okay. Mr. Carton, is that your motion?
And so it will read on line 6 and 7, exempting such fines from constitutional revenue limitations.
Revenue and spending.
And spending. Okay.
Yeah. I'll second that. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Is there a semicolon after limitations, Ms. Gomez? Any other...
Do we really need to enumerate the State Attorney General, Secretary of State? Do we want to just say by the state or any registered elector?
Good question.
For the sake of brevity.
Again,
Mr. Carden.
I guess my question would be, are we going outside the four corners of the motion and whether or not that's within the scope of our, I think it's probably an improvement, but I don't know if it raises an issue or not of whether or not the title board is limited in what it can address on a motion for rehearing, and that seems Mr. Dunn is kind of
fair enough.
Self-initiated improvement.
my preference might be if it's not raised in a motion for rehearing.
Sure.
Any other suggested changes to the titles? If not, is there a motion to deny the motion for rehearing, except to the extent that the board has amended the titles? And I want to point out that the changes that we made in the title in lines what is now 1 through 8, conforming, or the same changes would be made in the ballot title and submission clauses. Clause in lines 9 through 15. Is there a motion?
Move to deny the motion for rehearing for proposed initiative 2005-2006, number 122, except to the extent of the changes made by the title board as reflected in the ballot title for the measure.
I'll second that. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. concludes action number 122. The time is 11:50 a.m. Let's then, Ms. Gomez, if you will put 123 on the screen. And pretty much had the discussion, I think. And I think probably the same changes would likely be made, possibly with another change, if I recall the discussion we've had so far. We may need to flash back and forth between 122 and 123 to incorporate those changes. But I think the changes that we made to 122, I think it would make sense to include them in 123. So the first one, I think, which Ms. Gomez is trying to get on the screen for 123, would be to revise the first clause after the in connection therewith so that it would read, prohibiting any deductions by state or local government from an employee's wages for political purposes, semicolon. I'll move that change.
Second.
Any other discussion? It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Then the other change is to insert, as Ms. Gomez has done on the screen, insert a new clause after violation in line 7 that reads, exempting such fines from constitutional revenue and spending limitations, semicolon. I'll move that change. Is there a second?
Second.
A second by Mr. Dunn. If there's no other discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. And then I think we had some discussion about the fact that this would put into the Constitution affirmative authority for state and local governments to do other wage deductions. And it would make some sense to me, at least, that putting that into the Constitution is something that should be pointed out to the voters.
I'd agree with that.
I'm not sure the best place to do it. I sort of hate to break up the clauses that we have right now that state the prohibition and deal with enforcement provisions about refunds and fines and enforcement, but on the other hand, it could come right after the prohibition, and it's the other side of the prohibition is that there's express constitutional authority for non-political wage deductions. Ideas?
Seems to me that notwithstanding your comments about perhaps some reluctance to break it up, the appropriate place for that does seem to be on line 5 prior to requiring following the second statement of prohibition.
Okay.
I don't have any language yet for that.
I'll start guessing at some, I guess. And maybe we would insert it. I'm going to pretty much mimic the language of the measure to start out with, at least. And where Ms. Gomez has the cursor, we could insert authorizing state and local governments to deduct from the wages of their employees dues or other monies that are not to be used for a political purpose. for a political purpose. For a political purpose. Semicolon. Mr. Gessler.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. If I may make a comment, I guess the first comment would be, for the record at least, that we would object to including this in number 123 because we think it's extremely insignificant. It doesn't create anything in the Constitution that does not already exist. In other words, the Constitution is silent on it. States have that authority, or state and local governments have that authority. This simply makes a comment in the state constitution which makes absolutely no change, no effective change in the Constitution. So I guess as a starting point, we would object to that. Secondly, if the board's going to, since I think I'm going to lose that on that objection, but if the board's going to do it, I would propose at least language perhaps saying authorizing such deductions for non-political purposes. And although I'm normally not a fan of the use of the word such, here the use of the word such clearly refers to the same types of deductions that are prohibited for political purposes. So it really creates that indication in a voter's mind that it's really the flip side of the coin. It's the, you know, you can't make these certain deductions for political purposes. You can make the exact same type of deductions for non-political purposes. So I think it would be a brief and succinct way to add it rather than requiring a voter to sort of grapple with the language this initiative plus who knows how other many initiatives.
So again, the suggestion is authorizing such deductions for
non-political purposes.
Non-political purposes. I mean, that seems fine to me. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I would only add that I think I agree with the language change, but I think I would disagree with Mr. Gessler on the merits of inserting that itself. I think what Mr. Ramey said is correct, that what we're really talking about is a prohibition on governments from prohibiting such non-political deductions.
Authorizing such deductions for non-political purposes. I think maybe just one word. Do we hyphenate or just say non-political as one word?
Dash.
Hyphenated? Okay. We seem to have consensus on. Well, it seemed like when I was working in the legislative drafting office, we did not use hyphens very often in this context, but I think it's fine. If the preference. I'm okay with the hyphen or the dash. Authorizing such deductions for non-political purposes, semicolon, I think is the proposal. I guess I'll go ahead and move that.
I'll second.
Seconded by Mr. Dunn. Further changes to the titles as previously set by the board. Look it over, but Mr. Cardin.
And I guess I will just, my last kind of a final comment would be that with respect to objection 9 on the motion for a hearing, that the title is misleading and that it fails to disclose which aspects of the proposed initiative would be effectuated through a constitutional amendment and which aspects would be effectuated through an amendment to the Colorado Revised Statutes, and the jurisdictional argument in objection number 1. I think that has some relationships. I guess I would say that I think the argument probably needed to be raised and made, but I feel as though the fact that the measure amends both the Constitution and the statutes does not raise a single subject issue and that the title is not misleading because it doesn't separate out the constitutional amendment and the what I would view as a conforming amendment to the statutes. Chairman.
There are no other motions with respect to changing the titles, then I would accept a motion to deny the motion for rehearing, except to the extent that the board has amended the titles.
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Mr. Dunn, seconded by Mr. Carton. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That concludes action on number 123, and the time is 12 noon. Do we want to take a short break? I think we do want to go ahead to number 126. We want to get that one done before 1 o'clock, but... Mr. Gessler.
Mr. Haas, for the record again, my name is Scott Gessler. On behalf of Stephen Durham, who's filed the motion for rehearing, I would ask that we defer this until approximately 2:30. My reasons are this. First of all, I realized, Mr. Dunn actually pointed out, much to my embarrassment, I had included a copy of a case that I cited in the motion for rehearing. I believe I included the copy of the wrong case. So I actually have copies here for the board as well as a copy for the proponents if they're here. This would at least give everyone an opportunity to read that case so that we can talk about it intelligently, and I think that will sort of streamline the conversation. I think there's a high likelihood this may last longer than an hour. I think it would not make sense to sort of interrupt it in the middle. My belief is that the proponents for number 109 are here and that perhaps the board would be able to hear that now instead of requiring them to wait. And just as a personal matter, it would certainly reduce my anxiety level as I continue to prepare to sprint out of here. So for those reasons, and I would also ask, you know, the board's indulgence. I know my motion for scheduling asked for 2:30. Obviously, I can't control the Court of Appeals in the event they're late, perhaps 3 o'clock. My sense is that it's highly unlikely this would take 2 hours, and so the title board would be able to finish by close of business today.
Any objection to delaying number 126 over to 3 o'clock? If not, then we'll do that.
And if I may approach, I've got a few copies for the case. And
I got one. I did put a steel over because I had to turn one out.
Thank you.
Sorry about that.
Okay, no problem.
Thank you very much.
We will take a 5-minute break.